welcome to Hinnom's Monument. In the Hindu tradition, there's a lot of debate, or in the Indian tradition more generally, about traditionally works are started with an invocatory prayer, and there's some debate about why people do that, and the general consensus is that it's done to remove obstacles and so that the work you're writing can be completed. But as some authors like to point out, there's a number of works that have an invocatory verse that were never completed. The author died, and so they go, so it doesn't seem to work. And there's other works that don't have invocatory verses that were completed. And so they go, well, why do we do this? And the general consensus is that, well, we don't really know if it works or not, but it's nice to do, so why not? So with that in mind, I thought to start our Vedic exploration into Vedic text with a little passage that is used in the ritual of initiating the student into the Vedic study. And we'll come back to that later as to the significance of that. But you have that there at the top of the handout. It says, may the Lord of Speech, Vachaspati, assign to me the strength and powers of the 777, who wearing every shape and form wander about. Exactly who the 777 are is a little unclear. There's lots of various interpretations that have been given to this over the centuries. Some argue it's a grammatical thing and it refers to language itself, the 21 forms of language, whether it's the sounds or the cases or so on. Some argue there are actually some divine beings or some sages, some semi-divine sages, who guard the sacred knowledge of the Vedas. Please come again, Lord of Speech. Come with divine intelligence. Lord of Treasure, make what is heard reside in me. Let what is heard be in me. Right here, stretch tightly speech and thought, like both ends of a bow with sinewy string. Let the Lord of Speech establish what is heard right in me. Let what is heard be in me. The Lord of Speech is called near. Let the Lord of Speech call us near. May we adhere to what is heard. May I not fail with what is heard. Here, fail not as may I not fail the exam, but rather fail. May I not sort of be hurt or come to something inauspicious by the knowledge that I've received. I'm afraid I ran out of handouts. Sorry. Now, we'll come back to this in a moment. But what we'll be doing in this and the following weeks in this term is looking at the key concepts of the Hindu traditions, the key ideas by looking at key texts. And I want to stress that each week we'll be looking at a particular text or in particular and the ideas that they teach, and look at the worldview that these ideas fit into. But this will not be a chronological sort of overview in a sense. Although we're starting with the earliest, but from next week onwards, it is not that the things we will be doing in week three will be later than the things we'll be doing in week two. These are traditions that emerge and develop alongside each other and continue to exist alongside each other. And so there's considerable overlap. So keep that in mind as we're going through this. But we start with the Vedic texts and the importance of Vedic ritual in our exploration of Hinduism, because this is often said to be the foundation of all later Hindu thought. And as we will see in the coming weeks, that is a very problematic statement in and of itself, and a statement that has to be qualified in numerous ways. But we will see that a lot of the later ideas and a lot of the later texts are in some ways related to this or make reference to these texts. And so an exploration into the Hindu traditions, this is a good starting point for this. Now, as you can see from this passage that we started with, what is strongly characterized in this hymn is the importance of speech. And it's perhaps something that we are not used to thinking of in the same way that they are thinking of this. We think of the Vedas as a set of texts that we can go to the library and we can pull it off the shelf and we can, you know, page through it and read the text. And that is what the Veda for us is. It's primarily, it's received through visual means. So we read the text on the letters on the page and receive the text in that way. But for the Vedic people, the Veda is speech. The Veda is an oral text. And so there's a lot of emphasis given on the importance of speech and the importance of hearing. As we hear in this hymn, there's a constant reference to may that which I've heard, may that which I will be hearing. Remember, this is a passage that is recited as the student begins his study of the Vedas. And so may that which I will hear, may that be firmly established in me. May that lead good things to me, and so on. And so, therefore, the deity that is invoked in that hymn, Vachaspati, is a relatively minor deity in terms of the number of times he's invoked, but is a very important deity because this is the guardian of the sacred speech and the guardian of the Vedas themselves. And therefore, he is invoked at the beginning of Vedic study in order to guide the student to come not just to receive the knowledge that from the teacher, the knowledge here being the actual text of the Veda, which the guru would recite and the student would then repeat after the guru until the student has actually memorized this, as we will see in a moment. But also Vachaspati, this deity, is invoked because there's an acknowledgement that the sacred speech of the Vedas is a difficult speech. It is difficult to understand. It requires study in order to grasp the meaning, but it also requires divine sort of help, as we get there in the second verse. Please come again, Lord of Speech. Come with divine intelligence. Give me the intelligence to be able to understand what these texts are saying. And this is important to keep in mind because, as we will see, as we will read through some of these texts, these are very difficult texts. And they're not just difficult for us, but they have been difficult for Hindus for centuries. Commentators have struggled with these texts, making sense of them, trying to understand what they're actually saying. Various commentators give very different readings of what they are. They contain grammatical forms that we no longer, that are no longer used in classical Sanskrit and so on. And they contain a lot of riddles as well. They contain verses that seem nonsensical, that say things that seem contradictory sometimes. As the Vedic texts themselves like to say, this is because the gods like that which is cryptic. And this is something, a refrain that occurs in a group of texts called the Brahmanas, and we'll say a little more about those in a moment, where they give interpretations of certain texts or certain ritual actions, and then you'll kind of go like, oh, this doesn't really clarify this for me, and then they'll have at the end, they say, but the gods love that which is cryptic, that which is hidden, that which is obscure. And so therefore, the Vachaspati is invoked, please give me the divine intelligence, come with your divine insight, because you're one of the gods, you understand what these texts are about. Please come and guide me in this. And so the texts are oral texts, and the texts are oral texts in the sense that the tradition looks down on writing. We have the notion that in order to preserve something, we need to write it down. They have the idea that in order to preserve something, you should not write it down, because if you write it down, you externalize the text, but if you memorize the text, you internalize the text, and therefore you're able to preserve the text and have the text constantly with you. As I said, this passage is used at the beginning of Vedic study, and what will happen is the way the Veda would be taught would be literally the student would be sitting in front of the guru. The guru would recite a particular passage from the Vedic text. The student would repeat that after the guru. The guru might correct the student if the pronunciation is wrong or if he makes a mistake. And this would be done over and over and over again until the student has memorized the entire text. Traditionally, it says that this takes 12 years, and you start at a very early age, as about 7 years old. And so by the time you're a young adult, you've internalized the entire text. You know the text inside and out. Now, this is quite a feat because the text we're talking about are quite substantial texts. And the text we're talking about, you have listed here on the second page of the handout, where you have this table. If you look there, it says Samhita, and then Rig Veda, Samaveda, Yajurveda, and Atharva Veda. These are the four primary collections of Vedic texts. They vary in length, but the Rig Veda, for example, is a text that consists of 1,028 hymns, which vary in length from about four verses to about over 60 verses long. So it's quite in a printed edition, it's a book that's about this thick. So this is memorized, over a period of 12 years until at the end of this, the student actually has memorized this. But then in addition to those texts, to those four collections, you have a whole bunch of other texts that you have listed below there that the student would be required to study as well. The four collections that you have there, Samhita literally means a collection, a putting together of texts. The four collections are structured around certain themes. And so you have the Rig Veda is the collection of Rig. So the Rig Veda is a collection of Rig. Of hymns, of passages that invoke the various Vedic gods and offer praise to these various gods. In academic works, you'll often see that the Rig Veda is taken as the foundation of all the other Vedic texts. It is generally seen as the oldest of the Vedic texts. And it's seen as the foundation because, as we will see in a moment, all the other Vedic texts are textually grounded in the Rig Veda. And so if the Rig Veda contains invocations and praises of the various gods, the Samaveda, for example, the second collection you have there, contains invocations to a single god only, and that is a god called Soma, who is both a plant as well as a deity who guards that plant, who sort of rules over that plant. And it's also a beverage that is derived from the pressing of that plant, which has intoxicating properties that is drunk during the sacrifice and that is offered to the gods in sacrifice as well. Now, the Samaveda is entirely in praise of Soma, but the Samaveda consists entirely of hymns from the Rig Veda that are altered to make the samans, the chants, the melodies that are chanted during the sacrifice. And so the Samaveda is derived from the Rig Veda and sort of develops that further into the praise of Soma. And similarly, you have the Yajurveda, which contains the yajus or the ritual formulas, the mantras, if you want, that are recited during the sacrifice by the principal priest. And again, a lot of the textual material of the Yajurveda is derived from the Rig Veda. Entire passages from the Rig Veda are cited in the Yajurveda and are incorporated in that text. There's a fourth Veda, which is the Atharva Veda, which is a very different collection. And you will find often references to the three Vedas rather than the four Vedas. And that is because the Atharva Veda is generally excluded, is excluded then in that category. Because the Atharva Veda is sort of moving away a little from the main concern of these three texts. These three texts are concerned with the Vedic ritual. The Atharva Veda contains passages, some of which are derived from the Rig Veda as well, but that are primarily used for domestic rituals, for the birth of a child, the consecration of a new house, for the appearance of new, of the teeth of a baby, and things like that, as well as a lot of spells or charms. There's a lot of love rituals in these texts. If you want someone to love, fall in love with you, if you don't want someone to fall in love with you, if you want someone to fall in love with someone else, and so on, you have material like that in there. And it also contains a number of important philosophical passages, passages that reflect on sort of the bigger questions of what's the nature of the world, where does the world come from, what is the nature of action, what is the nature of desire, and so on. And to those passages, we'll come back later in the term. Now, we have those four collections, and so when I become a Vedic student, I'm 7 years old, I approach a guru, a person who has memorized generally just one of those texts, so say the Rig Veda, but sometimes who might have memorized all of them, who then begins to teach me those texts, and begins to repeat this text, or recite this text to me, and I repeat it after that person until I've memorized the text. And while I am a student with that person, I am what is called a brahmachari. I am a celibate student who lives a life of austerity and who is solely dedicated to the study of the Veda and the service of the Guru. And so I would live with the family of the teacher, and who often might be my father, so there's not a lot of change there, but often can also be another person. And so I move into that person's family, I live with the family there for a period of about 12 years. I study with them, I live a life of austerity, I have no contact with women, apart from the wife of the guru, who I sort of regard as a mother in some ways. And then at the end of that study, I finish my studies. I am allowed for the first time in 12 years to take a proper bath. The brahmachari is not allowed to bathe. The texts that sort of talk about the life of the brahmachari say, well, if he gets really dirty, he can sort of quickly jump in the river, but he has to come out immediately because he lives a life of austerity, and he should sort of guard the energy, the power that is generated by that austerity within his body, and washing, sort of bathing, removes, sort of washes that power off. And so at the end of my studenthood, I am I'm finished with my studies, I bathe, I become what is known a snataka, one who has taken one who has bathed, I then am expected to get married, have children, and continue or start the performance of Vedic rituals with the texts that I've learned, and continue the recitation of those Vedic texts. And to give you an idea of how these Vedic texts would then be recited after you're done with your studies, if you look at the bottom of the below the chart on the handout, you have an overview of different pathas, of different recitations, of different ways in which the Vedic text would be recited, for them to memorize this text as accurately as possible. And so what you have there at the first one there, where it says Samhita text, this is the text, how it is actually in the Rig Veda. This is the opening verse of the Rig Veda. And so if you were to take the Rig Veda off the shelf, this is the text that you will find. So it says, Agni mide puravitam yagyasya devam ritvijam. It's an invocation to Agni, the god of fire, about whom we'll say something in a moment, who is the purohitam, who is the principal priest, who is yagyasya devam, who is the god of sacrifice. and who is the Ritvijam, who is the priest who offers at the seasons. And so this is a text, how it would have to be recited during the performance of the ritual. When Agni is invoked, this is the text that you're actually reciting. But in order for that text to be firmly embedded in your memory, so that you can recite it at the right time, in the right way, while you're doing all sorts of other things during the ritual, they train their students to engage in a series of recitations that start to modify this text, and that literally forces the student to know the text backward and forward. And so the simplest recitation is the padapata, the word recitation, where each word is recited individually, which in this case doesn't change that much, except for the third word, where you have puraha hitam instead of purohitam. Sanskrit has rules where that govern the ending of words, which are changed in accordance with the beginning of the next word. It's a rule called sandhi. So if a word starts with a voiced consonant, then the previous word will change in accordance with that to make it easier for pronunciation. So basically in the padapata, you dissolve those rules and you start to pronounce the words as you would find them in the dictionary, say. Not in the dictionary because they have case endings, but as they would be, you know, without those rules applied. But then the more important ones are the ones after them. So then you have the kramapata, the gradual recitation, where you go forward one word at a time. So you go agnimi ide, that's the first and the second word, and then you go second and third, ide purohitam, purohitam yagyasya, yagyasya devam, and so on. And so you move one word at a time. You then have the jatapata, the matted recitation, like matted hair, where you move two words at a time as well, but you go forward and backward and forward. So you see there, so you go AB, so first and second word, second and first, first and second. So you go, as you have there, agni mide, ide, agni mide, ide, purohitam, purohitam, ide, ide, purohitam, and so on. Then you have the kanapata, the dense recitation, where you do the same thing, but you go three forwards rather than two. And so you go 1, 2, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3. And so you get agni mide, ide ignim, agni mide, purohitam, purohitam, ide ignim, agni mide, purohitam, and so on. And then finally, a more complex one is a recitation known as the ratapata, which is not used very often, but is quite remarkable, where you start with two, and each sort of each time you add a word to it. So you start with 1, 2, 1, and then 1, 2, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1, and so on. And you have the whole thing there. Now they've memorized these texts, so this is fairly easy. I mean, this is not even one verse of a hymn, but the Rig Veda contains 1,028 hymns, with each a long series of verses. So they memorize the text, the entire Rig Veda, in this way, backwards and forwards. And the result of that is that they literally do know this text backward and forward. One of my Sanskrit teachers had from Chennai, from south of India. He was from a Brahmin family, and he had a friend who came in a Yajurvedic family and was taught the Yajurveda from an early age. And he says, I can actually go to him and say, what is the 1,222nd word of the Yajurveda text? And he says, it'll take him a while, but he'll get it right. And I can check it in the book and it will be right. And that's how well they know the text. And the reason they know the text so well is because there's a lot of emphasis given on the preservation of these texts. Remember, this is an oral culture. They memorize these texts in order to preserve these texts. And then you have, of course, the responsibility to then pass on the text to the next generation and teach your, if you have a son, you could be teaching your son that text, or teach someone else, so that the text is preserved. As we will see later in the term, this is very much a male tradition. Women are not allowed to study the Veda, and traditionally they're excluded from that. But we'll come back to that next week. And so The importance for that is not just to preserve the meaning of the Veda, but is also to preserve the purity and the power of the sacrifice in which these hymns are recited. And because all these texts, really what they are, all the four Vedas, with some sort of question mark here for the time being, but specifically these three, they're ritual texts. They're ritual texts in the sense that they either talk about ritual and praise the importance of Vedic ritual, or they are used in Vedic ritual. They have to be recited during the Vedic ritual. And so the Vedic ritual is the center of the entire culture, and everything focuses on that, everything contributes to that, everything is meant to the maintenance and the propagation of the Vedic sacrifices. Now, what is the sacrifice about? Why are sacrifices actually performed, or what do the sacrifices look like? To give you a sense of how the Vedic texts themselves think about that, on the first page of the handout, you have a very famous hymn from the Rig Veda, called which is often called the Purusha Sukta, Sukta meaning a hymn, something that is Sukta, well said, something that's beautifully praised, in praise of Purusha. And Purusha literally means man or person. And if you look there at the hymn, it's a very remarkable text that's very famous and that's still recited by in a lot of Hindu temples every day. And it starts, the man, the Purusha, has 1,000 heads, 1,000 eyes, and 1,000 feet. Having covered the earth on all sides, he resides over a space of 10 fingers' breadth. Now, exactly what that last part means, the space of 10 fingers, there's a lot of debate about that, and that's very unclear. And some say it's a space that is beyond this world. So as it says here, he covers the earth on all sides. He covers this world on all sides, and yet he's more than that. He exceeds this world by a space of 10 fingers. Some have argued the space of 10 fingers is the space within the heart. If you put sort of 10 fingers there, that he resides within the heart. And anyway, there's a whole bunch of other different interpretations of that, but it's fairly unclear. But generally, it's taken that he exceeds this world. He is this world. He covers this world, and yet he is beyond this world as well. The man alone is this whole world, what has come into being and what is to be. Moreover, he's master of immortality when he climbs beyond this world through food. And we'll come back to that idea in a moment. So much is his greatness, but the man is more than this. A quarter of him is all living beings. Three quarters of him are the immortal, the gods in heaven. With his three quarters, the man went upwards, but a quarter of him came to be here again. From there, he strode out in different directions towards what eats and what does not eat. And if you then skip the next verse, the text says, when with the man as the offering, the gods extended the sacrifice. Spring was its melted butter, summer its firewood, autumn its offering. On the ritual grass, they consecrated that sacrifice, the man, born at the beginning. With him, the gods sacrificed, and the sadhyas and the seers. The sadhyas are a group of gods who are very obscure. And again, there's lots of questions about who they are. Among both traditional commentators and modern scholars, but they're a group of divine beings who will be referred to again at the end of the passage. From that sacrifice, when it was offered in full, the clotted butter was collected. The sacrifice was made into the animals, those of the air and those that belong to the wilderness and those that belong to the village. From the sacrifice, when it was offered in full, the verses and chants were born. Meters were born from it. The sacrificial formula from it was born. Here, the verses is generally taken to be the Rig Veda. The chants are the Sama Veda. And the formulas, the ritual formulas, are the Atharva Veda. So they emerge out of this primordial sacrifice that is performed. From it, horses were born, and whatever animals have teeth in both jaws, teeth meaning incisor teeth. I don't think there's animals that have teeth in only one jaw. Cows were born from it. From it were born goats and sheep. When they apportioned the man, into how many parts did he arrange him? What was his mouth? What his two arms? What are said to be his two thighs, his two feet? The Brahman was his mouth. The ruler was made his two arms. His thighs were the freeman, the Vaishya. From his feet, the servant or Shudra was born. These are the four classes of Vedic society, about which we'll talk a lot more next week. The moon was born from his mind. From his eye, the sun was born. From his mouth, Indra and Agni. From his breath, Vayu was born. From his navel was the mid-space, the space between heaven and earth. From his eye, the sun was born. From his from his head, the heaven developed. From his 2 feet, the earth, and the directions from his ear. Thus they arranged the worlds, or thus they made the worlds. Its enclosing sticks were seven. The kindling sticks were made 3 times 7 when the gods, extending the sacrifice, bound the man as the sacrificial animal. With the sacrifice, the gods performed the sacrifice to the sacrifice. These were the first foundations. These, its greatness, accompanied it to heaven's vault, where the ancient sadhyas and the gods are. Now, as you can see, it's not an easy passage. But the first thing that sort of strikes, I hope strikes you from this, is the idea that is portrayed here of you have this sort of cosmic person who encompasses the whole world, whose arms and feet and eyes and legs are everywhere, and who covers this entire world, but is more than it, as it says. One quarter of him is here, 3/4 of him is beyond our perception, is elsewhere. This person is then sacrificed by the gods. The gods are performing a sacrifice with this person, as the sacrificial animal. And as we'll see, the Vedic ritual involves the killing of animals, the sacrifice of animals who are strangled and then dismembered. And so the same thing here, Purusha, this cosmic person, is killed and is then sacrificed, is dismembered. And then the second column, basically, that you have here, deals with what happens with the different parts of his body that are used in the ritual then. And so we get from him, from his body, come the three principal Vedic texts that deal with Vedic ritual. We get the animals are born from it, the space, the sort of heaven, earth, the directions, the intermediate space is born from that, the sun and the moon is born from that. Indra, who's the god, the chief god, the king of the gods, he is born from that. Agni is the god of fire, he is born from that. Vayu, who's the god of wind, is born from that. The different social classes are born from that. And so what it is saying is that everything we perceive in this world, whether it's social, whether it's cosmic, whether it's the fauna and flora in the world, all of that arises from this great cosmic primordial sacrifice that is performed by the gods. And what it is saying then is that just as we look at a human person and we see a symmetry in the body of the human person, in the same way, we find a symmetry, a structure within the world as a whole. And that structure corresponds to the structure found in the body of that cosmic person, of Purusha. And that structure arises through the performance of sacrifice. And as we will see, is also therefore sustained through the performance of sacrifice. There's also a number of questions that this hymn raises. One of the big ones is the gods are arising from this sacrifice, but the gods are also set to perform the sacrifice with Purusha, with this cosmic person. And this is a question that is quite that arises and is quite typical for these sort of texts. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But the important point for that now is what it is saying is that we have a world of the animals, we have a world of human beings, the four classes of human beings, and we have a world of the gods above them. And all of them are sort of woven together, or kind of linked with each other through this primordial sacrifice, and therefore the sacrifice that links all of them together. There's a very beautiful hymn elsewhere in the Rig Veda that gives the image of the gods who are performing the first sacrifice, and the image that is given is they're weaving this great tapestry of the sacrifice that encompasses this whole world, that sort of envelops this whole world, that forms the foundation for everything in existence. This world is woven into the fabric of sacrifice. And so the sacrifice, the threads of sacrifice, keep this world together, keep the sun and the moon from, you know, sort of in place, keep the social order intact, keep the gods in their place, keep the animals in sort of, you know, happy and healthy and all those things. So you get this notion that there is this order in the world, and sacrifice is essential to that order. Without sacrifice, there is no order, and if sacrifice were to stop, there would be no order. The order would collapse. And this is the notion that is central to Vedic thought of Ritta. And Ritta is a difficult term to translate, but it's often translated as sort of cosmic order, the structure. It also means right, sort of things are proper, and so it means the sort of the world as it is, as it should be, is when it is like that, the Ritta is maintained. If Ritta is destroyed, if the order of the world, the proper nature of everything in the world were to collapse, were to sort of cease to be, there would be chaos in the world. And the important thing is that everything is part of that order. We are part of that order. The gods are part of that order. The natural world is part of that order. That order is beyond any of those beings, and we're all kind of caught in that. We're all a part of that, and therefore we all have a responsibility to act in a particular way that will enhance the greater good of the entire world. Our duty, as you get here then in this hymn, is to perform that sacrifice, to perform the sacrifices to the gods, through which they, as you get in the very beginning of the hymn, it talks about Purusha as he, in the second verse, he's master of immortality when he climbs beyond this world through food. And this is the way the Vedic texts often talk about is we feed the gods through these sacrifices. We give them nourishment through these sacrifices. And it is through the nourishment that they receive through the sacrifice that they're able to grow, to sustain their strength, and to sustain the order in the world that they govern to some degree. Because the Vedic gods, as you get there in the verse 13, where it talks about the various deities that are born from this primordial sacrifice, you have Indra, who I mentioned is the king of the gods, but he's also the god of rain, and he is invoked for rain and for fertility. And similarly, Vayu is the god of wind, Agni is the god of fire, the Maruts is a group of gods, or the gods of storm. You have the goddess Earth, you have the rivers are goddesses, you have Surya is the sun, the deity of the sun, you have Savitri, who is he's also a solar deity, but he's not actually the deity of the sun, but he's the deity of the impelling power of the sun, that when the sun rises, the whole world wakes up, and the power that the sun has over the whole world, that is the power of Savitri, who's connected with the sun, but is not quite the sun in that way. You have Soma, the deity that I mentioned earlier. He's associated with the moon, particularly in later Vedic texts. And so you have all these deities, and they're all guardians of natural phenomena. But they're not just the guardians of natural phenomena, but they're also identified with those phenomena themselves. And so Agni, who is in some ways the most important of the Vedic gods, is the god of fire, in the sense that he governs fire, he presides over fire, but he's also fire itself. And so when Agni is invoked in the ritual, he's invoked through the fire. The fire is kindled, and through the presence of those flames, Agni is there. And he is the most important of the gods because it's through him that we make offerings to all the other gods. And so Vedic ritual is primarily sort of fire rituals in the sense that offerings are made into the fire, and Agni carries those offerings to the gods and offers them to them. And so he, as we have in that passage, you know, the opening verse of the Rig Veda, as I said there, he's, you know, it says, Agni Mide, I worship Agni, who's Purusha, who's the chief priest. He's the priest because we make offerings to him, but he then makes the offerings to the gods. And so he's like the priest of the gods. And he's Yagyasya Devam, he's the deity, the god of the sacrifice itself. And so we make the offerings to the gods. The gods then are able to do their part in sustaining the order of the world. But it's important to keep in mind that in most Vedic texts, the emphasis is that the focus of the worship is on the gods, but the gods are seen as being part of something bigger than themselves. As we have in this hymn, Purusha extends beyond them. There's this being that is bigger than them, that is bigger than this entire world, and from whom they all come to be. Now, who that being is there's some debate about that, and as we will see in the following weeks, there's various ways in which this is read and interpreted. The way the Rig Veda itself interprets here very clearly is that deity is sacrifice itself. As you get in several places in the hymn, for example, in verse 7, it says, on the ritual grass they consecrated that sacrifice, the man. The Purusha is here identified with the act of sacrifice itself, who then becomes the sacrificial victim and who is then used in the sacrifice. And at the end, in verse 16, the final verse, it says, with the sacrifice, the gods performed the sacrifice to the sacrifice. And so with the sacrifice, meaning with Purusha, who is the embodiment of the sacrifice itself, the gods perform a sacrifice for the sacrifice. The deity to which they're making offerings is sacrifice itself. And so what you get, particularly in later Vedic texts, is the emphasis on yajna, on sacrifice itself, as the ultimate deity. This is the focus of Vedic ritual. It is the worship of the various gods, but in a sense, it is the power of the sacrifice itself that is important here. The gods have powers, and the gods can bestow things upon us, but the power is really in the ritual itself, which is the thing that sustains the order of the world, that helps us to play our part in that rita, in that cosmic order, by making offerings to the gods so they can play their part in that bigger picture. But in a sense, it is a sacrifice itself that is of utmost importance here. And later theologians who develop sort of their theologies based on these texts go so far as to say that really this is what it is all about. The gods do not have any independent power, they argue. And this is, the Vedic texts themselves don't portray it in that way, but later theologians sort of take these ideas to their logical extreme and say, actually, the gods do not, it's not that when I perform a sacrifice for Indra, that Indra goes, oh, I'm really pleased, I should give this person something, and therefore I give. They argue, no, when I perform a sacrifice to Indra, Indra is compelled to reciprocate. Indra is compelled to send rain or to give gifts and so on, because the power is in the sacrifice itself, and Indra himself, who's the king of the gods, is controlled by that ritual. And those same theologians even go so far as to say that whether you actually believe that the gods exist or not is totally irrelevant, because the gods are basically on the same level as the wood that is used in the sacrifice. where they argue just as you need wood in order to kindle the fire, you need an object for your worship. So you need to offer, you make the offerings to someone. So the gods are on that level. There's nothing special about them because the power is all inherent in the ritual itself. Now, this is not what the impression you get from the Vedic texts themselves, but you see sort of seeds of these ideas in those Vedic texts that they then develop and in that way. Now, and you see this is why they emphasize the preservation of these texts in the way that they preserve them. You need to memorize these texts in the proper way. You need to be able to recite these texts in the proper way. Not just that you need to know the words, but you need to know the intonation of these texts, so that when you perform the sacrifice, that the sacrifice is performed correctly. Because if the sacrifice is performed incorrectly, the sacrifice is actually not performed, because the sacrifice is codified. This is how you perform the ritual and not otherwise. And so when you perform the ritual, you have to do this exactly in the right way, because then there is actually a sacrifice. If you deviate from it slightly, it is no longer a sacrifice. It might have an effect, but it will not have a beneficial effect. And so that's why they emphasize, you know, learn these texts by heart, backwards and forwards, so that you can do this at the right time, in the right way. It also means that the sacrifices are very complex. For the most simple sacrifices, which are performed daily, every morning at sunrise, every evening at sunset, it is a very simple ritual that takes, you know, a few minutes. Doesn't require all that much time or all that many texts to be recited. But some of the most complex rituals can last for over a year, and some of the most complex rituals require you to hire up to 16 priests who are able to each have their own function in the ritual. Each has to be specialized in one of these texts or one specific part of these texts, and is able to then perform the ritual in the exact way. Often with the most complex rituals, you'd have a priest that becomes associated with this text, that, as we said, sort of is not directly concerned with the ritual, but it's one particular priest of those 16 whose main focus, whose main task is to just sit there and correct anyone who makes a mistake. So if he doesn't do anything, that means the sacrifice went fine, no mistakes were made. But as soon as someone makes a mistake, he has to intervene and correct that person, which means he has to know everything of all the other priests, everything that they should be doing. And so there is sort of some sort of system built in to try and prevent mistakes from happening. But the main sort of system that is built in to prevent mistakes from happening is sort of built in even before the sacrifice is performed by the complete memorization of these texts. Now, the presence of importance of yajna, of sacrifice, who is here personified in this sort of cosmic person, complicates things a little bit, obviously, in terms of the theology of these texts. What are these texts actually teaching? How are they looking upon the gods? If you read these Vedic texts, they seem very confusing at first. If you read the Rig Veda, for example, you have hymn after hymn after hymn in praise of the principal Vedic gods, particularly Agni and Indra and Soma. These are the three most commonly invoked gods. Indra is the king of the gods, Agni as the priest of the gods who brings the offerings to the gods, and Soma as the intoxicating beverage that's most dear to the gods. That's the focus of the most complex Vedic rituals, the sort of culmination of the ritual performance involves the offering of Soma to the gods and the consummation of Soma by some of the priests involved in the ritual. And so these are invoked most often, but you have, you know, a whole range of other gods. The number of the gods it varies from text to text. Generally, it's a multitude of three. So there's talk about 33 gods or 3,339 gods and so on. But if you read these descriptions of these deities, you'll get, for example, to a hymn of Indra, and it will be talking about the might of Indra, the greatness of Indra, Indra who propped up the sky and kept the sky from falling onto earth, or Indra who sort of sustained Siddharitta, the order of the world, or Indra who gave birth to the sun, and so on. And then you read a hymn to Agni, and you get the exact same descriptions to him. And then you read a hymn to Surya, and you get similar descriptions to him. And it's a little confusing at first, where you get sort of hymns that are addressing a particular god, that praise this god as supreme, and ascribe all sorts of things to this god, and then move on, you know, you move on to a different hymn, and you find the exact same thing. And part of this has to do with the poetic language of these texts. And so the Rig Veda is a text of great poetry, and when it describes, for example, Agni as giving birth to the sun, it is not sort of seen that Agni is the creator of the sun, but Agni is invoked in the Agnihotra, in the most simple ritual that is performed at sunrise, and so just before sunrise, actually. And so when Agni is invoked in the morning, then immediately after that, the sun rises. So in that sense, Agni can be said to give birth to the sun. In the sense also in that Agni contributes to the Iritta contributes, sort of keeps the sun from rising, and therefore in that sense, Agni can be seen as giving birth to the sun. So some of that is involves some of these sort of contradictory or seemingly contradictory statements can be resolved that way. But the other way in which these Vedic texts address the different gods is that their attitude is that when you worship a particular deity in the ritual, that deity is the only deity that is of importance. And so all the attributes of the other deities can be ascribed to that single deity. And so you can invoke, you can praise Agni as Indra and as Soma and as Surya and as Varuna and as Mitra and as Rudra and as Vishnu and so on. All these deities are kind of now represented through this one deity. And it is not, as some as it is sometimes understood by modern Hindus, that this means all these deities are one. The Vedic texts clearly see these deities as individual deities with their individual sort of realm sphere of influence, but it means that this deity is the only important deity to be worshipped now, because he has to be invoked now, and therefore all the other gods can be invoked through that deity. And when the ritual shifts to another deity, now that deity is the most important. So anything that can be said about the gods can now be said about him, because all the other gods don't matter at this particular point, because at this particular point I have to invoke this particular deity. Max Müller, over 100 years ago, therefore argued that the theology that we find in the Vedic text is not a polytheism of many gods, but is what he said, first he said a henotheism, and then later he called it kathenotheism, which is... which he says is different from monotheism, monos being the Greek word for one only. Henos means one, or katheno, one in succession, one after another, where you invoke the deities, consider that deity as the supreme, but then move on to the next deity and do the same with that. And so it's not quite polytheism, but it's not a monotheism either. Of course, all this is greatly... made more complex by the deification of sacrifice itself, where there you come to a deity that is actually an action that is given the supreme importance, where you read the text like the Purusha Sukta, and that act of sacrifice is like a creator deity. It is everything in this world arises from the personification of that ritual, from the power of that ritual, and everything is sustained by the power of that ritual, and that ritual has power over the gods and so on. And so it becomes very complex. What kind of theology is that? It's not a monotheism, obviously, because it's sort of It's a sacrifice. It's an action that they're talking about. It's not a deity, and yet the sacrifice is sometimes personified in various ways, as we get here. But at the same time, you have to keep in mind that this here is often read as a hymn of creation, as an account of creation. And the Rig Veda has several accounts of creation, and the supplementary Vedic text has even more accounts of creation. And if you read them one after the other, you get bewildered very quickly because they all contradict each other. And they all have a similar pattern, but they all talk about something very different. And this is not that this is a, you know, you could say, well, maybe this is just sort of different authors who wrote these individual texts that were then put together, and therefore that's why we find the contradictions. This is not why these texts are contradictory. It's because these texts, in a sense, are talking about creation, about the act of creation, and yet they're not talking about the act of creation, because they're talking about sacrifice. And they're talking about sacrifice as the creative power that gives rise to the order of the world, and that gives rise to the wealth and the opulence and so on that we will attain by the performance of the sacrifice. And so here, is this really describing how the world came to be? And this is kind of the difficult part that I pointed out. The gods are the ones who are sacrificing, and yet they're born from sacrifice. And so they're kind of interlinked with the sacrifice. And this is because these texts are not actually describing the act of creation itself, but are giving importance to the performance of the sacrifice that then can be conceived of in terms of sort of a creator of the world, which means that when I perform a sacrifice, I am like a creator of the world. And some Vedic texts are make that very explicit, that when I perform a sacrifice, I give birth to the sun, and I perform the ritual in the morning, and therefore I'm like the creator of the sun. And when I perform a sacrifice, I am the one who's structuring the world. And it's not sort of a statement of arrogance of, you know, look at me, how important I am, because the power is not in me, but is in that sacrifice, in the act of sacrifice itself. And it's because I'm doing it through the sacrifice that I can think of myself as doing that. But that's how these texts are supposed to be read. You have a passage at the end of the handout, which we won't have time to read now. But this is if you want to read this on your own, this is a passage that gives one of those creation accounts, which is very confusing and very colorful and so on. But if you get to the end of the passage, you start to realize, okay, what's going on is very different from creation. It's actually describing a sacrifice. And the ritual acts that Prajapati, the creator deity, performs here are basically the ritual acts that the Agnihotra, the simplest of rituals, entail. And he's sort of basically performing this. And so the idea is, I, as the priest, can meditate on this ritual in such a way that I am like this, and this will be the effect that you get at the end. That's how these texts often talk about them. And we'll come back to that in later weeks, as we see other texts that sort of take a similar or different approach from that. But anyway, that's sort of a very brief and whirlwind of an introduction to Vedic ritual. We will be returning to the ideas we've been talking about now in subsequent weeks, as we will see other texts and sort of referring to these ideas, modifying these ideas, building on these ideas, or flatly disagreeing with those ideas. And so if all this is confusing, don't worry. I hope that by repetition, this will become clearer as we go along. But that's the sort of, in a nutshell, the nature of the Vedic rituals and Vedic texts.